Hello, everyone, and welcome to Anarchy SF, the podcast companion to the Anarchy SF website. My name is Eden, and I am joined, as ever, by Yanai. Hello, Yanai.
Hi, Eden.
How are you holding up with the winter?
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, it's kind of cliche to talk about the weather, but it is. You know, we talk about not weather, but climate a lot on this show, so maybe it's relevant. I just came back from Iran, and I told you that I had to literally defrost, and I don't use the word literally lightly. I had chunks of ice in my hair.
Yeah.
Like, that I could crush with my fingers. That's how bad it is.
It's Iran. Pretty cold in most of Europe and North America. So if you're listening to this and you're in those areas, we hope you stay warm. Of course, this is all perfectly fine and nothing to be concerned about. It has no long-term ramifications or connections. It's just cold, and maybe don't think deeply into that because it will ruin your day.
It's cool. Kind of sad that, like, just this is what, you know, like, life is kind of gonna be like, you know.
Yeah.
COVID also kind of happened, among other things, because of, like, density, deforestation. These things all contribute to, like, the spread of zoonotic diseases, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, you don't get a virus with a signature that says, like, this is because of environmental collapse.
Yeah.
You don't get, like, someone dying of frostbite in the streets with a signature, you know, this was environmental collapse, signed Mother Earth.
Yeah.
But it's just going to happen. Just going to.
Yep. I mean, I think the horrible tension is between the fact that even without climate change, this always happens, and it has happened like 200 years ago before anthropomorphic climate change started. People were still freezing in the streets. And now they're just going to freeze more. So it's like the tension between this has always been bad, but it's about to get much worse, which kind of sucks. And of course, you know, all the victims of communism jokes, right? Where wherever anybody fell in the streets of Moscow in 1950 and died from like unrelated injuries, then it was mean old Stalin personally like executing them with a gun to the head. Whereas, you know, people dying of hunger and frost and heat and all that shit is not really capitalism's fault, right? And we can just move on and chalk that up to natural disaster or, you know, just the cost of doing business or whatever.
To a podcast talking about, that's not the subject of the podcast, but they were mentioning, you know, the kind of naturalization that comes with ideology where, you know, the ideology frames itself back into the past as, you know, it's always been like this.
Yeah.
They attributed it to Althusser. Marx already said this about economists.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of describing the world in economic terms and kind of pretending that they're just describing a scientific understanding of the world. And yeah, if you naturalize capitalism, if you say like capitalism just is the way the world is, then yeah, you know, it's not at fault for anyone dying because it's just how the world is, right? Like you can't blame. Communism is when you like, you know, you go against nature and you do some stuff. Capitalism just is like you. We don't get up every day and do capitalism.
Yeah, it's just the way of the world. Another thing I attribute to Althusser is murdering his wife with an axe. Listen, I think Althusser was a fascinating thinker and had like a lot of really interesting ideas, but he also murdered his wife with an axe.
If you're thinking like there must be like more to this story, no.
No.
It's just a wife murder. Like there's
I mean, he did, not that it's an excuse, right, but he did suffer from like very deep and problematic, in the sense of personally problematic, mental illness, right? However, lots of people have mental illnesses or difficulties and they don't murder people with an axe, whereas he did. Okay, but we're not going to talk about Althusser today. Well, maybe not directly. We are going to be talking a bit about climate change because we are going to be covering space sweepers.
Yeah,
space sweepers. Yeah, go ahead.
The way I wanted to talk about this transition, I think that space sweepers is like a science fiction-y ass science fiction movie.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when you start like getting depressed about how it's really hard to like get people to notice what's kind of happening with the reality, it's like very mundane. Science fiction can sometimes like be a kind of rude awakening or at least some escapism from that, where like we can take the problems and make them concrete and something you can shoot at.
But let's tell the listeners about Space Weepers before we dive into it. So this is a South Korean film. You could classify it as a space western, right? Think about, you know, dashing gunslingers and ship captains in space fighting against evil. It was directed, by the way, we are probably going to butcher all of the names that took part in this movie because most of them are South Korean. But this was directed by Jeon Sung-hee, who interestingly did a lot of like all of his other films. A lot of them are box office hits, by the way, were really pulpy. Right? In 2012, he made A Werewolf Boy. Yeah, it is what it sounds like. And also made Phantom Detective in 2016. So dabbled in a lot of...
a lot of pulp in this one too.
Oh, for sure, yeah. But it's, I think, less pulpy than a film about a werewolf.
Sure.
He has also been kind of like a Western darling for a while now. Nominated and won prizes at the Cannes Film Festival and in a bunch of other international film festivals, including in South Korea as well. Space Weepers was released in 2021. And in case you didn't know, South Korea has this like very productive and prolific movie scene. In the last few years, of course, we got Parasite, but also Train to Busan and a bunch more South Korean films. And, you know, South Korea is an interesting place in the sense that it has a lot of connections to the US for obvious reasons, aka the Korean War and the mm-hmm. foundation of the country for US military power. But it's not just about international or political connections. It also has a lot of cultural and economical connections to United States. That being said, it has its very own local and unique economical system, which shares some similarities with the Japanese system in the sense that there are like pseudo zaibatsus, you know, family businesses that mm-hmm. control a lot of the South Korean market, like Samsung, for example, but also many other companies. However, it's not like the Japanese economy in the sense that the penetration there of international capital and culture has been marked and very extensive, but not as extensive as its Japanese counterpart. And Space Weepers is made inside of these tensions, right? You know, it was released on Netflix. It's considered like the first Korean like sci-fi blockbuster. And while a lot of it is in Korean, it also has a lot of international themes, which we will discuss later. And it's kind of very obviously made to be consumed also by non-South Koreans. Of course, the examples here will always be to Parasite, right? Which had a lot of also like discussions around how much it's directed towards South Koreans, how much it's directed at people in the West, and so on and so forth.
I feel like this is more international than Parasite by a long...
I think in some ways, for sure. I think in general, the kind of science fiction that it makes is very Western, right? But on the other hand, I think it's immediately less accessible than Parasite just because of the language choice, right? Not just the Korean, right? But also it uses French and Afrikaans and a lot of other languages mm-hmm. that make it kind of, I don't know. I agree with you that in general, it's more palatable. Right, it's more fitting with the aesthetic or what people in the West might expect from a film like this. But then in other ways, I think it does things a bit differently than Parasite did, which is not better or worse, right? It's just interesting. So just to cover like the basic plot before we jump into spoiler territory and we start to dive into the themes of the film. Late in the 21st century, Earth becomes basically inhabitable. It's like a desert, dust wasteland. And of course, there's a big corporation called UTS, and they build a space station, right? The space station mm-hmm. is where you can, you know, have life and parks and clone animals and make sure that they're...
The first 10 minutes of this movie is a reimagining of Elysium. Like,
yeah, basically. it's basically the Elysium premise. Now, of course, in that space, there are a very stratified society where a lot of non-citizens come up from Earth every single day to do the dirty work of the elites that live up in the space station. And among them, we have space sweepers. As you know, space is filled with trash because humans have to destroy every single thing they put their dirty hands on. And so you need people going up in these small vessels to start to salvage, right? Clear the debris so that you don't get, check this out, Kessler syndrome, right? Which is when space debris becomes so extensive that it creates a chain reaction and basically crashes everything in Earth's orbit. So they're cleaning up. Of course, they make bounties off of the salvage, but the bounties are extremely unfair and don't cover the costs of doing business. So they're always in debt, locked in this cycle of being very hardworking, but also being poor. What a fantasy. That doesn't happen to anyone in real life, right?
Yeah.
Of course, they stumble upon an android, or what they think is an android, spoilers, although it's very obvious, which has escaped from the labs of the Big Bad. And this is Dorothy, right?
Big Bad, but it's trying to save humanity.
Oh, yeah, of course. Wait, which one is the... girl, oh yeah, Dorothy, right? She's like the child android. And of course, this android is touted as this like super weapon or the new breakthrough potentially for humanity and so on. And they stumble on this android and they have to decide between helping her and risking all their lives. Of course, they're all jaded in different ways. So let's introduce our characters. We have Kim Tae-ho, who is the main character, I would say, played by Song Joong-ki, who is a very prolific and by now famous South Korean actor, who's played in many very, very, very good films. And he's a fantastic actor. I really, really like him. He was also in Werewolf Boy, by the way, which we spoke before.
His breakthrough role.
As a werewolf, yeah. So he is the soldier, once captain and illustrated officer of the enforcers of the station, now fallen from grace. We have Tiger Park, the former drug baron on Earth that has escaped to the space station, is now the mechanic. We have Bubs, the ship's android. So think about R2-D2, but interestingly, non-binary. And, of course, how can you have a Western without Captain Jang, the jaded...
By the way, I thought they were transitioning to be a woman.
Yeah, but like, I'm doing the non-spoiler stuff, right? So, like, in the beginning... No, it's fine. In the beginning of the movie, they're, like, non-binary, right? They're, like, struggling with their gender identity. And then at the end, yeah, they transition to become a woman, which is fantastic. And then Captain Jang, the jaded... and aloof and solo ace captain, right? Played by Kim Tae-ri, who is also a very by now well-established actress. She played in The Handmaiden and Mr. Sunshine and Little Forest and a bunch of other South Korean films that, and Hollywood films that became quite famous and celebrated. Mm-hmm. Cool. So that's our cast. That's our basic premise. And now we can dive into the actual topics.
Yeah, before we get to spoiler territory, I don't know if it's preferable to watch this before listening or after, but every thing we cover on this show is a recommended thing. We only cover things we like. I think this one, I wouldn't say that it's like the best or anything, but it is the easiest to recommend, I think, of the things we've discussed, because there's something in here for everyone. Like, It's a cool little space romp with like a lot of action, a lot of like touching stuff. It's just fun. You know, yesterday I watched as a kind of like with friends, like a pop movie. We watched Fast and Furious 7. Don't do things like this to your brain. It's bad. Watch Space Sweepers. That's good.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a masterpiece, right? Like, it didn't shake my life or whatever, and it plays all of its tropes and its cards very, very straight. But one, the CGI and the design is really, really good and well made. And what by well I mean tastefully, right? It's not overused. There are some bad parts with the villain, but you know, whatever, he's the villain, right? And he's like the least interesting part of the movie by far. The action is good, the acting is really solid, and just everything is well made. And yeah, like you said, it's a fun romp of a film. That's also why you shouldn't be afraid of spoilers. It's not, you can tell the entire plot of the movie by the like first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But that's not why you watch it. So let's do spoilers. Yeah. I want to get like the elephant out of the room and talk about the villain. And kind of like why, I'm not going to say I was disappointed, because it was very obvious that they were going in that direction. So I was kind of ready for it. But I think it's the weakest point of the movie by far. First of all, from a writing perspective, but then also from a political perspective, right? The villain is played, by the way, by Richard Armitage, a very well-respected English actor, right? He played in a bunch of British television, including like serious quote-unquote productions. like Arthur Miller's The Crucible, but he also played in Hannibal, the American show Spooks, fantastic British television, and then a bunch of other like spy novels, and other all sorts of adaptations. By the way, he was also the Demon Prince Bellicor in Total War Warhammer 3, one of my favorite games, and he has such a good voice to play a demon, right? He has like this deep voice, and that's why he plays the villain. So the first thing is, the villain is British, which is phenomenal, because...
Just like in real life.
Exactly, based on a real story. He plays the ultra-rich owner of UTS, of the space station, and he's... it's interesting that they went with like the bioengineering angle, right? So he's Elon Musk, or maybe I should say Jeffrey Epstein, because Jeffrey Epstein dabbled in a bunch of bioengineering. And he's
Peter Thiel, Peter Thiel, for sure.
He's like a mesh of all of them, and he's going to save humanity by like, you know, growing this superfood on Mars or whatever. And obviously he's not doing it for that, right? Like he's experimenting on himself, making him into kind of like a superhuman. And as the movie progresses, he becomes more and more depraved and violent and just starts killing people. And at the end, you know, personally tries to go after the group. Now, let's tackle the writing first, which I think is not great. Like his motivation is very weird. Like, why is he experimenting on himself? Why is he doing like the Ubermensch thing? It's not really explained. The superfood thing is, right? Like, that's going to allow him to abandon Earth. By the way, he wants to blow up Earth because he doesn't want that dead weight, right? So some eugenics and Malthusian stuff in there as well.
He has an origin story that is unclear, because it really sounds like he's lying about it. Like, you know, he came from nothing or something, but it kind of sounds like a lie. And also, usually when billionaires say that, they're lying. So.
Yeah, but it's just never fully explored or explained. And it's very obvious that he's just like a deus ex machina, right? Like he's there to just move the plot along and whatever. And it's a shame because you don't really need him. Like if the story was just trying to get the girl, the small child, right, away from the authorities, and there wasn't like a big bad running them, that would have been completely fine. But, you know, you need a climax. You need like a big blowout action scene. So you got to have a villain to do it. The thing is, it completely fucks up the politics of the movie, right? And what the movie is trying to say. And the movie is very, very not subtle about its like anti-capitalist messages, right?
Yeah, the movie is really dense with metaphors, by the way. We're going to touch on some of them, but like every fucking thing, like every character there is like a kind of representative of like a lot of shit happening.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree with that. And I think... So we're not reading into this when we say that it's extremely anti-capitalist. But then it's like, oh, but this one rich guy is the problem, right? Like the movie ends with them removing him and exposing UTS for what it is. And then it's kind of hinted that from here on out, people will live like freer lives on the space station. Although they do end up still as space sweepers, right? They're still going to do their job. But now it's better. For some reason, like they're still going to be doing this dangerous job.
They did a general strike of the sanitation workers.
Yeah, and
they want a new contract, basically.
Exactly. And then you don't see the system being dismantled. You don't see like the workers owning the means of production or whatever. They got rid of the big bad guy. Like if we. The parody satire in Minecraft, like woke up tomorrow and we killed Peter Thiel, then all our problems would be solved, And it's a really weird message for a movie that otherwise really focuses on systematic oppression. Like, one of the best parts of the movie is in the beginning, where the main character, Kim Tae-ho, he's looking for his daughter who drifted into space after an accident, and he pays in rice, right? Like, because rice has become this really rare commodity. And he has to make the choice between, literally between eating and finding his daughter, right? And it really nails home, like, he's fucked, right? There's like a million people lost in space. He's never going to find her. And every time he tries, it like kills everything that he made from his grueling hard work. It's like, this is a systems problem. Also, the people he encounters are not evil, right? Like, the bureaucrats and the guards that he encounters are just doing their job. But they're still fucking him because the system is bad. But then the next scene is like, oh, and also this evil rich British guy is at the basis of all of this, and he sucks like donkey balls, and they should kill him. It's like so dissonant. And the thing is, the last thing I want to say here is, like, to tie it back into the first level, the shallow level, is the writing, then the second level is the politics of the film, but then the third level is the real world politics that this reflects. And that is, don't get me wrong, I hate Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and Jeff Bezos just as much as the next guy. And it's good to, like, agitate and you know, say that we should kill them and eat the rich and all that shit. But that's, like, not even the first step, right? It's just something you do to vent, right? It's funny on Twitter. It's not interesting politically in any way, shape, or form. And there are a lot of people out there who, without noticing, I'm not talking about people who are, they have shallow politics. I'm talking about people that believe they have complicated politics, but most of what they do is channel those politics into saying, haha, Musk man bad. It's like,
yeah, it's an individualizing problem, yeah, that are systemic.
Exactly. And I want to say again, like, to put the finger on it, it's not nothing new, and I wouldn't raise it if it was just individualization, because that's something that's been happening for ages, and we talked about it on the cast before. I'm more referring to, like, this knee-jerk habit of not noticing how much time you spend on hating those people, mm-hmm, right? Like, on an unconscious level, you don't, like, organize against them, and you're not, like, writing posts about them. You do serious theory and serious practice or whatever, but then you spend a lot of energy and a lot of your time without noticing, just going off on them, because it's easy, right? They're pathetic. They're pathetic people, and it's fun and easy to make jokes at their expense, and you should keep doing that. But just, I caught myself, like, talking extensively about these people. I was like, I don't care that much. Like, I don't want the path of least resistance to be just making fun about these people. So the film kind of falls into that trap, and like, oh, we need a villain. Okay, let's just put, like, a random evil British dude in place. So,
yeah. And I think part of the reason, like, for this reaction from leftist people, which kind of swings into the point I want to make about the villain, is that the kind of ideology behind billionaires is that, you know, when you reach that level, when you're like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk or Bill Gates, you have, like, world-shattering power, and you have to tell a story about that. And the story often told is that these people love humanity, and they're trying to kind of, like, make the world a better place. You know, there's something honest about someone just like, yeah, you know, I'm just making money. Like, I don't know. at any level, right? Like, I don't remember, you once told me about a band of people, maybe it was Lamb of God, that were like, yeah, we're not friends. We're just, like, doing a band.
Like, yeah, yeah. Lamb of God are like, we're not friends. This is a business.
Yeah. And there's something so honest about that. Like, cool. Just go do your work. And it kind of feels like someone like that would become a billionaire because reasons. But in any case, billionaires like try to have a story around them. And I think the degree to which, like, the villain part works is, you're right, like, if it's focusing our politics on them, that's a bad thing. I think it's trying to kind of fight against the, like, adoration that there is of these figures in pop culture by kind of, like, making the point that billionaires hate humans and humanity. People who are that rich despise you. You being basically anyone who isn't that rich And that's for a couple of reasons. So how do people get that rich? It's usually through a set of occurrences that are like kind of 90% random. And you might say, like, well, how can one person, like, you know, randomly get so much? Well, it's because of survivorship bias, right? Like, there's a lot of people playing in the money field, and a lot of them, like, whittle away, and then someone gets so much money that suddenly they can't fail in anything that they do. If it seems that, like, Elon Musk, for example, like, seems to keep failing forward, that's because when you have a lot of money, like, you can make your failures into wins, because, you know, you can always kind of manipulate the stock market and be like, I know that the stock I'm boosting is going to crash even harder than everyone else thinks, so I'm going to, you know, do a buyback right now or do whatever. When you play, it's like playing poker with so many chips. So that's how people get to that level. But then they do walk the earth like gods that can, you know, that wield so much power. And they kind of need to have a story about, like, what is the relation between them and like the humans that they see all the time. And they have, so they have to start thinking about their superiority in some sense, because otherwise your brain would break. I think that if you're Elon Musk, you see the person who's cleaning your office, and that is just a cognitive dissonance that you have to do something about. And I think what happens is that they develop this kind of idea that they are these weird, you know, gods among men. And that's, you know, that's why eugenics starts to be so compelling, because, like, what if we could create more such gods? And that's when they start creating these schemes of, like, I think that's the only interesting thing about the villain, that, like, yeah, you know, let's all move to Mars, but, like, the connection between let's all move to Mars and let's blow up the Earth. So the idea is, like, he wants some people, the people he can get in a kind of eugenicist selection method, he wants them to move to Mars, and he wants to blow up the Earth so that there's no alternative or something.
Yeah.
And he's going to terraform Mars to a degree. And that's the kind of logic of someone who has so much money that they think they're a god.
Yeah.
And I think, so I said this is a movie dense with metaphor, and I think the metaphor here is to, you know, the way that discussion about it's so funny because, like, we're recording this in a time where, like, Elon Musk's ass is so out, like, like, it sounds almost ridiculous to say, like this is kind of deconstructing him. But I really think that, like, half a year ago, it was way harder to explain to people that Elon Musk is just an, I don't even think he's an idiot. I think he's just, like, an averagely intelligent person. Like,
yeah.
Like, just you shouldn't give this much power to anyone. Like, not to me. It's not like I would do a better job or something. Ideas that Musk has for Twitter are, like, not even, like, terrible ideas. They're just the kind of ideas you think of when you think, like, what would I do if I was head of Twitter or something? But then there's supposed to be a whole team that will kind of check if those are good ideas, like, actually. Never mind. I'm rambling, but...
So I think if you mentioned, like, what's good about the villain in Space Weeples, because we talked about what's bad, I think the actual good thing about the villain in that movie is the antidote to him, right? At the end of the day, the antidote that Space Weeples offers to the bad guy, but also to the system, the co-op system that he's working on, is internationalism, right?
Wait, you're moving to the next point. I have a final sentence about...
Go for it.
Because I didn't. So the metaphor with destroying Earth, or the kind of thing being hinted at, is that talking about, you know, space exploration and terraforming is insane when you have, like, we can't terraform the planet we're on right now, which is already, we've evolved to live on it, right? Like, why don't we make the Earth more hospitable? It's already hospitable, like, and we can't, like, kind of improve the climate here. So why would we think that we can do it on a new planet? That's the kind of logic of someone who thinks that they're bigger than life. And then like the reality of the existence of Earth just becomes dead weight.
Yeah, I agree. There's this meme where it's one of the most depressing memes on the planet, I think. I'm trying to find it. That goes, iPhones are big enough or something like that, or they shouldn't be bigger than like a certain amount. And your humanity's greed has turned our heaven amongst the stars into a tomb.
What?
And it's like a bison saying it, right? It's like a bison in a bunch of trees, and it says phones shouldn't be that big. You've turned Earth into a horrible wasteland just so you could have big iPhones. So like this idea of, yeah, let's go terraform a planet after we completely fucking destroy this one. And this one, it can still be salvaged, right? It can still be quote-unquote saved.
Or yeah, that's part of the end of this movie. It's like, yeah, why don't we use the terraforming we have to kind of make things better on the planet we already have?
Yeah, for sure. So going back to my point about the solution to all of this, mm-hmm. And it's kind of, again, a parallel to what we need to do to maintain this planet is internationalism, right? The movie starts, one of the best scenes in the movie, it's like the first 5 minutes, right? Which is the space sweeper's crew, our protagonists, doing their space sweeper job, and they're kind of assholes, right? Like they're the best, but they don't follow the camaraderie and the rules of the trade. They don't recognize first come, first serve, right? They race to a piece of salvage and they fuck over all these other crews, even though there's like a thieves agreement amongst them that whoever sees the salvage first is the one that gets it, because they don't want to fight and engender their ships. But these guys are like gung-ho lone wolves, right? And all those different ships are like French, there's Afrikaans in there, Chinese, one crew is like Americans, right? There's Arabic, Egyptian crew, if I remember correctly, and they're all extremely international. Now all of these countries have been dissolved, right? Because the Earth collapsed. The countries don't exist anymore. There's only UTS and the space station, and then whatever remnants of humanity are dying on the planet. But people are still speaking their languages, and they have some sort of like universal translation, right? They all understand each other. And I'll come back to that in a second. And then at the end, like the big Avengers Assemble team up fight scene where everybody comes together and saves the day, is the crew has to understand that they're part of a bigger organization. They basically have to show solidarity, right?
Yeah, the thing I jokingly call the sanitation workers strike, because sanitation workers. And
For sure. But they have to see through not only the international differences, but also the protagonist crew's past transgressions, sorry, right? Like the other space sweepers have to say, okay, these guys are assholes, but now they need us and we need to come together, which is a very interesting point, right? Because what's it trying to say is you should look for allies even in places where past relationships aren't exactly perfect, right? Like don't show up to a picket line and say, oh, there are Trotskyists here with me on the picket line, I'm gonna go home instead of standing with them because they like Trotsky, right? Or even like more serious things, like, you know, two chapters of a competing like unions or whatever, they should come together to do a strike, even though they might hate each other in normal days. But then also in a deeper sense, they have to kind of come together around their mutual interests, right? They all have this common interest to rebel against this villain. And right now it doesn't matter who is leading or who is the asshole. They all have to do like coordinated action to succeed. The thing is, because it's a space western and not like quote unquote a serious film, it does interestingly give itself a big break, which is the universal translator, right? And I don't care about the language barrier, although that is a big problem. I care about what it stands in for, and that is all of the differences that we have between each other as workers. So a lot of times, quote unquote, tankies simplify things by saying, yeah, workers in different countries have more in common between themselves than they do with billionaires. And while that is true, it also buries how many differences there are. And they can't just be paved over by class relations, right? Like, sure, I have more in common with a worker in, I don't know, South Africa or South Korea or Poland or whatever. But if I were to try to organize with one of them tomorrow without doing any preliminary work, that would completely fail, right? So then the question becomes, and this is a question that the left has been asking itself basically since the First International, right? How do we work together? How do we overcome our differences? And by the way, if you look at all the greats, you know, Lenin and all those guys, they failed many, many times to do that. Like the whole French Socialist Party thing that completely split off from the Second International, and the Social Democrat Germans, and a bunch of other, like, and this is inside of Europe, right? This is not like, you know, people from completely different sides of the planet trying to speak to each other. So the movie doesn't have time or doesn't have the desire to convincingly solve this problem. So it hand waves it away with a universal translator. And not to say that this is a criticism of the movie, just the canvas that they have. But this is a really deep question that I think the movie inadvertently raises. Like, how? How do we do it?
I recently, so this academic semester is over, and I took a class that went into a lot of pragmatism. And pragmatism does some things that are similar to Marxism, but they do it in the US, so it takes on different forms. And one interesting thing that is highlighted in that tradition is pluralism and kind of value pluralism and the kind of constructive relativism, where you think about, you know, a group of people being very diverse and that being a good thing, and kind of how to respect other people. So one interesting writer in that context is Alain Locke, whose name I haven't heard until this year. But one of the first kind of American Black philosophers who wrote a lot about pluralism and relativism. And when he says relativism, he doesn't mean that ethics is kind of relative to the subject or to their culture. What he means is that if you wanna build a coalition of a lot of people, you need to understand that you're gonna have a lot of different voices, and your solution for that can't be to find an organizing principle that everyone is going to come behind, because that's just not going to happen. I mean, maybe sometimes it's going to happen, but it's going to collapse real fast if the kind of only thing that binds you is that you all believe the same thing. Whereas pragmatists had ideas of like radical democracy, where you kind of try to contain the fact that people are very different from each other and stay in coalition kind of despite that, which I find interesting. And I find a kind of failing of traditional Marxism and a way to do like kind of postmodern critique of Marxism, not just of the idea that it has like the narrative of the workers, but also that like expecting workers to, you know, just become only workers when they unionize, rather than like, you know, different people with different agendas and different conditions and different personalities that don't necessarily mix that easily, I think is bound for failure.
Yeah, and I think this is an interesting discussion. We could have like a fucking 5-hour episode just on this. You know, these are interestingly the questions that exactly the early Soviet Union had to solve. Like, it's in the name. That's the whole idea behind the Soviets, right? This idea of disparate groups of workers that can represent local interests, but then also meet on the national level and talk to each other and come to an agreement and democratically rule the state. Now, we know how that went, right? Like, very quickly it all collapsed upwards into the party, and the Soviets were dismantled. And again, I don't want to talk about whether that was good or bad, because the answer is both, right? Yeah. It had advantages and disadvantages. But just think about the challenge. I think that Space Weepers made me think about if it's so hard to do on a national level, how the hell are we going to do it internationally, right? Yeah. I think it's
the history of the forming of the State of Israel also has some of these issues, where like you have a lot of socialists thinking, we're going to do a socialism here, and then kind of like facing reality and oh, what do we do about the fact that, like, there's a people that was here before we came here, and, like, and we know how that didn't turn out that well, so.
Yeah, I think the failure of, like, the early Israeli left to join forces with the Palestinian left is one of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century. Like, there was such real potential here to form something else than, yeah, like, a fascist ethnostate.
They chose to sublimate their resistance rather, you know, they did the exact, so you know, the first ruling party, the socialist ruling party of Israel, had within its coalition an Arab party, but it was so kind of like subjected to the agenda of the ruling party that it wasn't really containing the multitude. It wasn't really handling the issue. So it's really actually failing on this exact issue, like not really being pluralist, but just kind of like subsuming your resistance as capitalism does.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned kind of like coming together despite the kind of personal failings of some people. And I think that's an interesting through line because, and sorry to bring us back to the villain that you don't like, but the villain has this weird move that he does twice that he kind of connects with his eugenics, where he gives someone supposedly a moral dilemma. Mm. So there's this reporter, and he and the reporter is critical of him. So he offers the reporter basically like a lot of money. Like basically he offers to move him, his family, to the space station where they can like live a good life.
Yeah.
And you know, in return for like not reporting. And the reporter, you know, struggles with this and decides to say yes to this deal. And then the villain executes him, you know, saying kind of like, oh, you proved that you don't like really hold these moral standards, so you know, so screw you or something. And I think that's a really interesting thing to let your villain do. He does that again with one of the protagonists, like he offers to reinstate her as a, you know, one of his crack team of terrible cops or something, and or maybe he does it again, and never mind.
Yeah, but he does it to the main character. He main basically character. Offers them all the money that he needs to find his daughter.
Yeah. And like it's really interesting because the movie doesn't, I think, I don't remember what the main character says in response to this, but the movie doesn't present this as a sincere kind of moral dilemma. But I think what is so interesting is how villainous it is to put someone in that position of having to, you know, compromise between the morals. And I think the point there is, you know, to distinguish between people's politics and their kind of personal actions. So, you know, classical Marxism is about, you know, serving your material needs, and you know, achieving what you need to achieve. And the idea is that having a revolution would serve the interests of the workers. It's not having a revolution because like that's what's right. He's actually critical of this way of thinking. He doesn't want, you know, communist parties to say like, oh, we're for justice, because he thinks that that capitalists have their own like idea of what justice is.
Yeah, and I mean just to hit on that point, it's one of my favorite things about Marx, because in a way you can see the germ that then became Foucauldian morals, right? Yeah. Because basically what he's saying is there is no such thing as an objective right. Right is defined by the people in power. And that is exactly the meaning of the proletariat of the dictatorship of the proletariat, right? We want to be the ones who say what is right and what is wrong. We don't want to do right. We want to take over the mechanisms that define right and wrong.
Yeah. And I think what's really clever about this movie is that what it says is like, fuck you to the person who would make you choose between, you know, saving your family and some ideal like political goal. That's not what politics is. Like, you know, it's really interesting. Like when we think about solidarity and we think about like people's like personal commitment to these grand projects, you know, people gotta serve their own interests, and we have to think about that when we try to bring them into coalition. I think about, for example, there's this really interesting group that's helping kind of sway, I think, coal miner unions in the U.S.
Yeah.
To advocate, they're called Sun something, to advocate against global warming, you know, against bad climate stuff. Where, like, I think the interesting realization is, like, we can't leave the people whose job it is to mine coal behind when we design a new future. We have to, like, we have to advocate for a solution to climate change that finds these people jobs. Because we can't just ask people to fight for what is right. We need to make it so that it serves their interests in some way. You know, people who are very who live very comfortable lives, like you and I, can think in a way that's like, you know, how are we gonna, like, make the world a little bit better for other people? Because, like, we feel pretty good about our own life, and one big source of anguish for us is I mean, tell me if I'm incorrect, but, like, one source of anguish is that we constantly see other people suffering, and that's just mind, yeah. Like, it's really, like, that's a big problem for us, because our like immediate material concerns are met. So
yeah,
so
we
get to worry about that kind of stuff. And I think that's really interesting. And it's really interesting also in the way that, you know, most people get their kind of politics and their news from social media now. And social media is very, you know, it's very prone to moralizing, right?
Yeah.
So that's how we get this whole, like, you know, Bernie Sanders has 3 houses and, you know, how much money is someone allowed to have? You know, communism is when no house.
I think it's a very interesting point that you raised. And again, it goes back. It sounds like I don't like the movie, but I do like the movie. But it goes back to one of the limitations of the movie, which is it's again centered around individualism at the end of the day, right? And individual actions. I think it's really interesting that is the hardest part for us to shake off. And when I say us, I mean like capital U us, right? People are willing to fight with a lot of capitalism's assumptions, right? Like poor people deserve to be poor, and only if you work hard are you entitled to security and stuff like that. You can look at the US, and you mentioned Bernie Sanders, right? Like, we can leftists, and I mean leftists, right? Like communists, Marxists, anarchists, and so on, they have an easy time agreeing or getting people to agree with 90% of what they say, right? Because people, not a lot of them are actually rabid Republicans who want poor people to die.
Well, it's so far that you see rabid Republicans like adopting this kind of faux anti-corporate bullshit because it's so
exactly
popular.
And then I've had this experience several times, very frustrating, where you're walking someone down this path and you're like, okay, well, do you agree with me that every single person deserves the right to have a roof over their heads? And they're like, yes, of course. Do you agree with me that everybody should be able to eat and raise their children and have security over their body and so on? And everybody agrees with those things. And then you ask, like, okay, so how do we do it? And what I'd like to tell you is that the only way to ensure that that happens is for the majority of people in society to have control over the mechanisms that get to decide what happens with that society, right? And then you get like a 50% fall off, right? Like 50% of people will say, well, it doesn't work like that. Some people are more talented than others. It's not about numbers. It's about ability, blah, blah, blah. Whatever, discard those guys. And then you're left with the 50% to say, okay, well, isn't that what we have today, right? Like we live in a democracy, right? We are allowed to vote. And then you get into the real stuff that is hard for people to accept, where you say, yes, but that's not how freedom works. Like, you think that freedom is just a multiplicity of choices, whereas I, and when I say I mean Marx, Nietzsche, Foucault, Kierkegaard, all this tradition of thinkers, have shown us that that's not the definition of freedom. That's just the definition of choice or excess. Freedom is about the ability to control the mechanisms that get to decide for us what is worthy or unworthy. And if we join those two ideas together, that in order to ensure all those things that we agreed on, we need to control those mechanisms, what you get is the dictatorship of the proletariat. And then you lose like 98% of all the people that stayed in the conversation. That's a real problem for Marxism. Like, we can scoff and say, oh, they're wrong or they're idiots or whatever. But it is a big problem that we have of convincing people of this point, because it goes directly against every single thing that people have been raised to think. And the system, you know, the schools, the culture, whatever, has done really good work at reinforcing these ideas. And now we come back to Space Weepers, and I'm asking the question that we asked about Parasite as well, right? What is the worth of making a supposedly radical film if it still operates under all of the assumptions, the basic assumptions of the industry in which it is published, right? Like, in what sense is Space Weepers interesting or leftist or radical and so on, if it again collapses into the questions of individualism and of protagonists and antagonists, right? Which play into this idea that, you know, it's about choices. Like you said, it's about the dilemmas of taking the money or getting the job or sacrificing your ideals and so on. That's not an interesting question. It's not an interesting question in your life as well. Like, if you specifically work for a corporation or not. Yeah, again, there are awful people working for Raytheon or whatever, and like private mercenaries, and that's not a good thing. But it's also not like...
what the problem is.
Exactly. It's not the problem. And most people don't work for Raytheon. Right, like they work for much more benign corporations. So the question then becomes less what choices did they have, but more in what sense can we say that they were free to even choose this to begin with?
Mm-hmm. It seems that the movie is kind of struggling against itself, where, you know, it's always the struggle of making, well, propaganda, and I mean this in a good way, in a capitalist landscape where you need to hit on the kind of traditional beats that make people connect to a movie.
Yeah.
And then you can put in these dilemmas and clarify that these are the tools of the villain. Like, the villain wants you to think this way. The villain wants you to think that the choice, that it's about greed, that greed is like a, you know, I hate when people talk about greedy corporations, like, you know, as if it's kind of like a failure of virtue. Like, that's something that sets me off, like, immediately. Like, a corporation cannot be virtuous. It's a machine for eating up the planet. Like, it's not more greedy or less greedy. It's just the way that it's designed to be. It doesn't know any better. It can't know any better.
Okay, I think this is a good point to stop. We could probably keep this discussion going for a long time. Again, there are many, many different parts of this film. Like, we didn't get to talk about Tiger Park, which I think is a really interesting character. And it talks about, like, justice and abolitionism and restorative justice and stuff like that, which is really interesting. We didn't talk about Bubs and its the gender fluidity of this robotic entity that then becomes a woman. Even though a lot of people address them as a man throughout the film.
Yeah, the film, I think, is a little bit confused on how to do that, but it's
trying,
which is nice.
Yeah, it makes the effort, right? I also think it's not the subtlest thing I've ever seen. And there's a whole question of children and education and AI and a bunch of other stuff, right? But yeah, we want to keep this under like 2 hours if possible.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'll just this say, is, like, I think it's a really good movie to watch and think, like, it's a really good exercise in, I think, decoding metaphors. Like, everything in this movie is trying to be a metaphor for how capitalism sucks. You know, find all the clues. It's very fun.
Yeah, for sure. So I was thinking about what we should do next, and I have one real strong candidate, but I'm not sure I want to subject you to it.
Okay.
I've been playing Ixion, which is a game made by the same studio that made 40K Mechanicus, a turn-based game where you play tech priests. And this game, basically in the first 10 minutes, what you see is an Earth destroyed by climate disaster, of course. And there's an ultra-rich person, of course, whose language is couched in pseudo-religious metaphor, who built a space station that can jump faster than light and is going to colonize Proxima Centauri. But then when the ship turns on its engines, it blows up the moon and jumps like 100 years into the future. And then you find yourself in Earth where everybody's been killed, basically, and you try to recover civilization and find your way to this habitable planet. It is like Frostpunk in space, but it is extremely hard and punishing, very difficult game, and also extremely depressing. But as I say this, I remember that you actually really liked Frostpunk.
I did.
So yeah, you so might like... Yeah, so this one is also very punishing. It doesn't have its polish. There's a lot of like quality of life stuff that I would change, but it is a fantastic game with a great soundtrack and a lot of obviously like politics and what it means to be human and like survival and what we do in the face of hardship.
I was slick of doing one book, one non-book.
I don't think that's like a law, right? Obviously, we can find some books to cover. But that's what I've been doing. What else have you been consuming, for lack of a better word, recently?
Well, let's commit to doing Ixion. I have had term papers to write, so I have been consuming academic papers. Do I have anything interesting to say about those? No. So I will tell you that I watched Fast and Furious 7, and that is good anti-capitalist propaganda, because watching that movie will convince you that we need to destroy anything that led to the creation of that movie.
some of the latter ones are supposed to be better.
I watched 7, so it's one of the latter ones. They jump in a car between buildings. And I mean, I could forgive that if anything about the movie was good. I have nothing good to say about that movie. It broke my mind. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, doesn't sound like a fun time. Okay, so next time we will do Ixion. And we will apologize in advance for how depressing it is. But it is a great game. If you want to check out more anarchist books, games, movies, we have some comic books in the pamphlets, a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. You can go to anarchysf.com. I will no longer say that one day I will release version 2.0 because honestly, it's been so long now. But the site's great. Enjoy it. Check it out. And we will see you next time. Yeah, bye-bye. Thank you for listening.